Sometimes I think I should shut up and not say the things I say on podcasts.
David Senra.
David Senra.
The guy's name is David Senra. He's got a podcast called Founders.
To even get on Founders podcast, you have to be so good at your job. Somebody wrote a book about it. That's an insanely high bar.
It's almost like it's an obsession.
It is. I'm addicted.
I've known you now for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I think you are crazier now than you were.
I'm not balanced. I don't think I can be balanced. I don't think I want to be balanced. I want to be the best in the world at what I do. People are like, oh, 10,000 hours. I'm way past that, like way past that. So of course I've changed. I'm not doing this to stay the same.
The difference between the world's greatest and pretty good, it's not a little bit better. It's not 20% better. It's like 1,000 times better. And that is hard to grasp.
Mediocrity is invisible until passion shows up and exposes it. I've become intolerable for people that are casual, and I don't even know why I'm like that. I think I was lying to myself for a while, that I don't need anybody else. I wanted professional success to say I was born in the wrong environment, and I will prove to you that I am not like the rest of these people. It's almost like a revenge for being born.
Are you a happy person?
I don't think you're happy.
I feel like I can rule the world. I know I could be what I want to.
I put my all in it like no days off on a road. Okay, so you have to look this guy up, Eliud Kipchoge. You have to see what he looks like. He looks more like a gazelle than a human being. Because the thing about world-class athletes and runners is you see them like when they're exerting themselves and like wearing their like running gear or whatever. And so they're like, yeah, he looks amazing. But then you see him in real clothes and you're like, oh my God, that person is so much skinnier, has so much less body fat than the average Joe. How on earth are these two human beings, both human beings, like a normal person versus Eliud? And so he runs the marathon, I think, in like 201. Just like 4:36, I think, for the mile. Crazy fast. And what we were saying was the difference between the world's greatest or the best there ever was and pretty good, you know, it's not a little bit better. It's not 20% better. It's like 10 times better or 100 times better.
Or 1,000.
Or 1,000 times better. And that is hard to grasp. Do you agree?
Yeah. I mean, you asked me, like, what am I thinking? Right before we started recording, you saw what I was doing. You're like, what are you thinking about? And I was like, I'm thinking about how this looks. And he's like, but does that matter? I was like, everything matters. Like, we're trying to be the best in the world at what we're doing. So, like, we have to take everything very, very seriously. I think the only thing I'm obsessed with, there's actually one of the best pieces of advice I ever got that I won't shut up about, and I think about literally probably every day now, is this idea of constant refinement of association that my friend Jared Kushner told me. And Jared is unbelievably honest. There's a great line in, we were talking upstairs, I just finished reading Bruce Springsteen's autobiography. And there's a great line. He talks about his deep friendship that he has with Jimmy Iovine. And he's like, you want Jimmy in the room because he'll tell you the truth. Like, everybody around Bruce is kissing his ass. And like, Jimmy's just like, this album sucks. Or this is great. You like, trust his judgment. And Jared's like that too, where he's just like, if he's your friend and he likes you, he's very kind, but he will like, hey, that what you're doing is not good enough for you. This person is not good enough for you. Be careful with this. And so this constant refinement association is important because as you keep getting better at what you do, you get access to people that are great at what they do too. And there's a lot of commonalities between them. And then once you're exposed to that, I always have this line that mediocrity is invisible until passion shows up and exposes it. I've become intolerable for like people that are casual with the way they push their work, or the friends they choose to hang out with, or just anything that is not them striving for excellence. And I don't even know why I'm like that. It's just I have to be the best in the world at what I'm doing. And so
or
that
is
what
I'm like that, or did you become like that because you've studied 400 biographies of greatness?
That's a great question. I don't know. Michael Dell has this great line in his autobiography where, you know, he, at the time he's 19 years old, he's in his dorm room at the University of Texas, he's got $1,000 and he's like, I'm going to compete with IBM. That is delusional. IBM at the time is the most valuable company in the world. It was the first company, I didn't even know, I had to go back and research this. The first company to get to $100 billion market cap in history was IBM. And you have this kid that's like, I'm going to compete head to head with them. And the next line when he's talking about this is, was I a little full of myself at 19? Sure I was. I think you have to be to do anything special. So I always had this like deep, just like delusional self-confidence and like default optimism that like, if I focus on something, I will figure it out. I will figure out how to do this. But I also think it's impossible. Like, I've obviously changed. I've been doing Founders Podcast for almost 10 years. It's like, I think I'm for like, I don't know, 407 of these books by far. That's hundreds of thousands of pages. That is, people are like, oh, 10,000 hours. I'm way past that. So of course I've changed. I'm not doing this to stay the same.
Well, I've known you now for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. and I've listened to you for longer than that. I think you are crazier now than you were. I think you are more obsessed now than you were.
Sometimes I think I should shut up and not say the things I say on podcasts because I don't like having a filter. I don't like having two different sides of me. It makes me fundamentally uncomfortable. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm just not going to hold back. I'm just going to say this. I just did this when I went on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And I talked about, Tim didn't tell me what we were going to talk about other than he told my team, he's like, please tell David not to curse so much.
That's what I told you 5 years ago.
And I don't think that came from Tim. I think that came from Tim's team. And I think we accomplished that goal. But he started asking questions and I hesitated for a half a second in my mind or half a minute. I'm like, man, I should not say this stuff. This is going to be bad. And I just let it go. And since then, I was just on the phone. I won't say who I was talking to, but it's a founder of a public company. He's relatively young, wildly successful. And he was just like, hey, I listened to your Tim Ferriss interview. And he's like, I know exactly what you're talking about because I went through that too. And you hear that over and over again. So to answer your question, am I crazier? Is that the term that you use or more intense? I think I was lying to myself for a while. And if you look at episode 222 of Founders Podcast, it says Ed Thorpe, and in parentheses, it says my personal blueprint. And Ed Thorpe's a legit genius. I am not a genius. Whatever he directed his talents to, he was going to succeed because he's a legitimate, I think, fundamental, genius. And what I liked about him was, he was, a real balanced person. You would love him.
Yeah.
Because you are like this. And I think you're truly like this. A lot of our conversations are like this. Where, essentially, bounded his professional life. He was very successful. I'll give, a quick TLDR of his life. He was the person that invented, how to count cards in blackjack. He was a mathematician and he was
a
professor for a long time. He wrote a book called Beat the Dealer, which tells you how to count cards. The 1960s, sold millions of copies. He started the first quantitative hedge fund of all time. He was one of the first investors in Berkshire Hathaway. He meets Warren Buffett when they're both in their 30s and he gets in the car and he's like, that guy's going to be the richest person in the world one day. And he invented the world's first handheld wearable computer with Claude Shannon, who's the father of information theory and another genius. It's just how did one guy do all this stuff?
Yeah, like the Forrest Gump of finance.
That's a great way to think about it. And so, but he was also he came from a real messed up family. He got into weightlifting and fit, taking care of his health before there was anything bodybuilding. And he said the way he's figured this out, he was in college time. He's like, well, the way I think about this, and at every hour that I spend in the gym working on my health now is one less day in the hospital when I'm 80 or 90. He went on Tim Ferriss' show and you look at him and I'd show pictures. I'm like, how old do you think this guy is? They're like, oh, he's 60. He's 92 or 90 or however old he is. So anyways, his whole thing was I want a balanced life. He would work, 9 to 5, thereabouts. Then he would spend time on his health, his work, his family, and then he'd like to have fun. And it was much more balanced life. And then he also did something which was fascinating where once he made more money than he could ever spend in his lifetime, he also didn't like to travel like you. He has this beautiful house in Newport, California. And every time he travels, he goes, this is a downgrade. Why did I leave my house? Once he started, had enough money that he didn't need more money, he stopped trading time for money. And he had these are layups. Oh, I could make $30 million on, investing in this oil thing or whatever the case is. It's just whoa, what's the point? And so for a long time, because by that time I'd read, 200 of these books. And I was like, oh, he's an outlier and outlier. Most of these people are just singularly obsessed in their work. And so for a long time, I think I was lying to myself, yeah, I want a balanced life. And it's just no, I'm not balanced. I don't think I can be balanced. I don't think I want to be balanced. I want to be the best in the world at what I do. And again, I narrowly define that. I'm not trying to, I think the narrow definition is important. And that's kind of what I think about all day. That's what kind of drives me. That is when I feel comfortable. And maybe I'll change in the future, but I am fundamentally uncomfortable not working towards some kind of professional goal.
All right, I read a ton. I would say almost a book a week. And the reason I read so much is because my philosophy towards reading is I want to see what worked for the winners that I love and what strategies they use. And then I want to see what mistakes did they all make? What were the common flaws that they all had? And I just want to avoid that. And so HubSpot asked me to put together a list of the books that have changed my life so far in 2025, and I did that. And so I listed out 7 books that made a meaningful difference in my life, and I explained what the differences that they had on me or what actions I took because of the book. And then also I listed out my very particular ways of reading because I'm
pretty strategic about how I read and how I read so much and how I remember what I read and things like that. And so I put this together in a very simple guide. It's 7 books that had a huge impact on my life. And you can scan the QR code below if you want to read it, or there's a link. You guys know what to do. There's a link in the description. Just go ahead and click it and you'll see the guide that I made. So it's the 7 books that had a massive change in my life this year so far. And then also how I'm able to read so much. So check it out below.
So I read a lot. I read 1 to 4 books a month, mostly history. You do more or the same. How do you become sensitive enough when you read something to know that that is a point that is worth remembering? Because there's been so many times where I've read something and I will forget it, right? I love the American Revolution, and then like I'll reread books. I'm like, I didn't even remember about this or that. You do a really good job at recall. You've done it many times here, and you do a really good job bringing the points of the story that actually matter. And I think this is an important lesson to learn of how do you be sensitive enough to see what is important and what isn't, and then use that to change your life.
I was like a big believer in intuition and just like this like constant refinement of your own taste. Like I'm sure I did not have that skill in September 2016 when I started, nearly to the degree that I have it now. Right before Kobe Bryant died, he was asked this question about like what he had sees in like Steph Curry that it makes him such a like formidable competitor. And he's like, there's like a calm, this is Kobe describing Steph Curry. He's like, there's like a calmness about him. And he's like, and when you match this like calmness and belief in what his skill set is with his intense desire and work ethic to practice and to get better, like that is a very dangerous combination. And what he was referring to was Steph says, people always ask me what I think about when I'm shooting. And he goes, absolutely nothing. And so I don't overthink this. I read the book. If something, it's all intuition. It's this line is speaking to me. This is jumping out to me. I'm going to underline it and I'm going to jot down on notes exactly what came to my mind right now. Do not overthink this. Just like, you know this stuff over and over again. Because like we see Steph hitting a crazy 3-pointer in the Olympics, like to win. You know, I watched that clip the other day. We don't see the million other times he was alone shooting the 3. I always say the public praises people for what they practice in private. The other thing about this taste, what I realized is when I talk to a lot of other people that are really great at what they do, other entrepreneurs, people that want to be great at what they do but aren't yet, I was like, they're trying to figure out, like, why am I not breaking through? It's like, because you're not actually interested in this. Like, you are lying to yourself. I am intensely interested in this. You could ask my partner, Rob. We go through this all the time with the new show about like, hey, let's get this person. And like that person's like a big name. And
like, I just don't give a shit.
And I'm like, but this is the way I think about my work. Okay. Like the only way I'm going to do this for the rest of my life is if I'm doing it for the right reasons. And so I cannot overcomplicate things. Munger has this line where he says something about like the hardest thing to do is to remember why you set out doing what you're doing and to keep things simple. Right. And to do that for a very long time. So the way I think about it is like Founders is the books that I'm intensely interested in reading. Right? Not just a book that I think is going to get a lot of downloads. There's been times where like, I was like, read this book. I read it. I hate that guy. And I literally throw the book across the room. I was like, I don't want to spend a week in that guy's mind. Founders is the books I'm intensely interested in wanting to read and enjoy reading. And the new show, David Center, is the people I'm intensely interested in having conversations with. I was on the phone with somebody yesterday and I text her and I was like, I want you to fly to Malibu and I want to do a show with you. And she's like, are you out of your mind? Are you crazy? Because she feels, because of the guest list has been like kind of...
She's below.
Yeah. And she's, I was like, and she sent me this funny meme where it's like, where like Big Bird is sitting at like a table and like everybody else is like, it's just like a normal office and you got Big Bird. And she put like Daniel Ek and Michael Dell and all these other people I've had and then her name on this. I'm like, that's not what I'm interested in. I am intensely interested in people that have singular careers. They are doing what they do in a way that is completely natural and authentic to them. And they kind of have like an inner scorecard. So like they're willing to make decisions that may not make sense to you, but make sense to them.
Have you read The Inner Game of Tennis?
No, but everybody tells me I should.
So listen to this. So I think I think the guy's name is Tim Galloway. The idea is that he wrote it in the 1960s or maybe 70s. He was a tennis instructor. And so he was like trying to get his students to be better tennis players. And he developed this idea of self-1 and self-2. Self-1 is a critic. And so when you would hit a ball, you'd say, shit, that was horrible. I got to move my hand this way. I got to do this. Self two is someone who doesn't listen to the brain, but listens to the body. And you'd be like, well, I practiced this 1,000 times, just like Steph Curry. Like, I don't need to criticize myself. Instead, I'm going to be objective and I'm going to be like, let's try moving our hand just a little bit this way and let's just see what happens. That one, that didn't, that hit that we just did, that didn't achieve the desired outcome. What would happen if I just do this? And you just kind of feel it. And so the idea here is that you listen to your body more than your brain. And it's very similar to what you're saying of like being simple and being following intuition. And in fact, this book, I think Bill Gates is the most recent person to write the foreword of the book. It was launched in the 70s and they've republished it. And it's now like a business cult classic. And the idea here is exactly what you're describing, which is like you keep things very simple. You practice a lot and you don't criticize yourself and you don't like think too hard about what will do well.
The criticism, and me and you have talked about this a lot, like in private, like we both were maniacally driven to fix and to achieve financial success. And a lot of times that doesn't come from a positive place.
Yeah. The way that I see it a lot of times is basically I build businesses because I feel like I have, I'm not good enough. And also I try to fix myself because you have to fix your personality in order to build a great company.
Mine is not that I don't think I'm good enough. There is like, this is going to be weird. One of my favorite movies is a movie called Tombstone. It's like one of my favorite things. And I watched it when I was a kid over and over again. And there's like a line where Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp are legitimately true friends. And Wyatt Earp is about to go and have a duel, like a life and death duel. He's going to meet this guy named Johnny Ringo. And he's like, we both have guns. One of us is going to survive and the other person is going to die. This is about to happen to me. And he's talking to Doc Holliday about like what drives Johnny Ringo to do what he does. And the performance by Val Kilmer is incredible. And he's just like, people like that have a giant hole in their heart that no matter what they do, they can't fill. And so then Wyatt asks the follow-up question, is like, what does he want? And he goes, revenge. Revenge for what? Revenge for being born. And I think what drives me, if you get into like how I think about it, is like, I wanted professional success to say, I was born in the wrong environment. And I will prove to you that like, I am not like the rest of these people. I knew that since I was like six. Like I felt very different for a long time. And I was like, and I'm going to do this for myself, but you're also going to see that I'm not going to wind up like these people. It's almost like a revenge for being born in the environment that I was, that like drives me. Now the self-criticism, you could be, my self-criticism for a long time, and you see this with a lot of high performers, is like, constantly negative, like overly negative. And what I've now changed to is just like, that drove me, right, to work all the time, to try to find a craft that you can be really good at. That has already happened. So that was useful for back then. Is it still useful to this day? And this is where Brad Jacobs, like who was, I think, the third person on the new show, I've talked to him about this a lot. You know, that guy's, this is the benefit of meeting these people now. He has more years of experience as an entrepreneur than I've been alive. The amount of information they can transfer to you in a hour-long conversation, a 15-minute conversation, in a sentence is not, you're not capable of doing that unless you have this like hard-earned wisdom from experience. And I'm reading his second book right now, which I don't even think is out. And so much of it is about him reframing negative thoughts into positive ways and the way he does this, because he realized that when I was just negative and beating myself up, I was not as effective. I thought that was a tool and it wasn't a tool. And so what I've been thinking about a lot lately is just like, man, that served me back then, that negative inner monologue. It doesn't serve me now. I always say like learning is not memorizing information. Learning is changing your behavior.
Yeah. So, but that's the hard part, because in general, people don't change. You know, Robert Greene has this great book called Human Nature. And he was like, in general, assume most people won't change.
Yeah, most people. I'm not trying to be most people.
But we still have that in us where like you have to fight inertia. And that's quite hard.
Yeah. So we were talking upstairs, this Bruce, because you're a Bruce Springsteen fan, and his autobiography. I would highly recommend people go watch this movie called Deliver Me From Nowhere, I think it is. I thought it was going to be a biopic of Bruce Springsteen. That's not what it was. It was about a guy that had an unbelievably tumultuous childhood that funneled that pain into an unbelievable work ethic to get him what he thought he wanted most in the world, which is being a rock star, And then right after he hits that, after, you know, years and years of struggle, he plunges himself into deep depression. And what he realizes is like, he can't form. His childhood was so messed up. It did not give him the ability to form stable, loving relationships with women. And what he desperately wanted was, he wanted a stable relationship. He wanted to have kids because he wanted to raise his kids and break the chain that his parents did to him. And yet what he would do, he would freak out. He'd be like, he'd fall in love with a woman or whatever the case was. And then he'd be like, something's wrong with her. She can't, if she loves me, I am unlovable. So therefore I'm going to hurt this person. He would run away and then he'd start dating somebody else. And he would go through this over and over and over again, right? Until the point where like he has to go wind up seeing a therapist. He basically is like, hey, my life is going to be miserable. I'm going to be world famous. I'm going to be wealthy. I'm going to have a job I love, and I'm going to be depressed and miserable. And the crazy thing about the book is 600 pages long. Half the time you're like, this guy, is the first half of the book is about his love for his work and his work ethic. And so you think you see where it's going. And then this curveball happens in his life where he's like, life is more important than work. What Bruce was figuring out is that every human wants like relationships, whether it's a romantic relationship or a true friend or something, somebody understands you that you feel that, like you can like do life together. And I now have like my friend group is crazy because of like how high quality they are in all the domains, like all areas of their life. And that was like, oh my God, it's not that I was like, that I didn't want to let people in or I didn't like other humans. It's like, I didn't have access to this before. And so like almost every single one of my new friends have come from the podcast. And in some cases, they've become like best friends, people that I've spent years getting to know and like spend hours and hours talking to. And so that's where it's like, oh, like this is actually really important to me. Relationships are really important to me in a way that I didn't understand. And maybe I was like lying to myself about this. And so that was like a huge learning for me. And then the reason I bring this up for the Bruce Springsteen thing is because he's messing up at something he deeply desires, yet he's smart enough to realize, hey, what are the tools that I need to fix this? Because if I don't fix this, I'm gonna have another 30 years, or in his case, 40 years of my life where I'm going to be miserable. So he's like, changed his behavior. That means he learned. You're not learning if you didn't change your behavior.
Today's episode is brought to you by HubSpot. Did you know that most businesses only use 20% of their data? That's like reading a book, but then tearing out 4/5 of the pages. Point is, you miss a lot. And unless you're using HubSpot, the customer platform that gives you access to the data you need to grow your business, the insights that are trapped in emails, call logs, transcripts, all that unstructured data makes all the difference. Because when you know more, you grow more. And so if you want to read the whole book instead of just reading part of it, visit HubSpot.com.
You know what's crazy? Every time I listen to your podcast, I have envy of the people, not because of their success, but because, like, particularly like Bruce, but there's a lot of people who found their passion very early on in life. And I don't know if that's luck, what it is, but I think that that's like whenever I listen to founders and now the David Sutter Show, I think like, how crazy is it? Like, we were talking about music. Whenever I go to concerts and like, if it's a band that I've loved for years, I loved Green Day for years, Billy Joe will play a song that he wrote when he was 15. And I'm like, how fortunate are you that you were able to create stuff at the age of 15 that's still relevant to you in your 50s or 60s? And so I get one of my favorite ones you've done. I didn't like this guy, but what's the Liz Zotica's guy's name?
Oh, yeah, Del Vecchio.
So basically, for the listener, this guy like started like a sunglass conglomerate that's a monopoly, and it's a $80 or $100 billion company, and he's tried to pass it on to his sons and try to make it a family dynasty. But there's a ton of like bad shit that he's done in his life with family. And he seems like a pretty like angry, generally angry guy.
He's like an orphan.
Yeah. Like
this is what I mean.
He had a lot of darkness,
but he never dealt with it. Where I just give you an example. Bruce is like, no, I'm not going.
Well, he dealt with it at the end. I think at the end of the episode, he was like, the thing that I wish I did differently was how I treated my children.
Yeah. But on the episode, I said, I don't believe him.
Right. And that's what you said. But what I do envy of him and many of the people is that they found their passion early.
I could see that, but like I was 32 when I found like what early I love to do.
Really?
Yes. Bruce Springsteen was 15. Kobe Bryant was like 11. Del Vecchio was what, 17?
Yes, he was young. Yeah. 32 was young. But the fact that you find it in the first place.
This is why you ask like, what are you doing? Why are you taking, like, you didn't say like, why are you taking everything so seriously? It's like, that is what I understand how rare it is for somebody to be able to make a living doing something that they love to do. This is why I hate, like, we talked about the fact that we don't really read Twitter that much, you and I. I hate, like, when I see people just, like, engagement farming, and they're like, the worst piece of advice you could ever have is, like, work on what you're passionate about. And they're like, instead, like, start a trash hauling business. And I'm just like, no, man, like, it's the best thing in the world, and it's excessively rare. And if you find it, you should do everything in your impossible to, like, hold on to it and to not mess it up. This is a piece of advice I got from Michael Dell. And he told me, he was like, tell me crazy stories. This is before we recorded the podcast together. We spent 5 hours talking. And he told me, he's just like, most entrepreneurs sabotage themselves, right? You're not taken out by, like, a competitor. Like, you do something where, like, you're having success, and then, like, you, I always say, like, the worst thing you could do is, like, you go to sleep on a win, you wake up with a loss, right? Jimmy Iovine, one of the things I learned from Jimmy, he's in this documentary, it's one of my favorite documentaries, called The Defiant Ones. He also had this, like, crazy 50-year career, is, like, the importance of actually having a full life with crazy experiences. And so, like, he did this episode of Rick Rubin 2 years ago. He just did another episode of Rick Rubin's podcast. I think it was in 2023. It was the best single podcast episode I listened to in 2023. And it's just like, I want that. I not only want to be really great at what I do, but I was like, I want to have a very full life. So Jimmy was kind enough, when I did a Founders episode on him, he said, like, 1,000 people texted to him, and he invited me to his house. And one of the pieces of advice, again, 72, maybe 75, something, it's probably 72. Guy has more knowledge, you know, practical knowledge is pinky than I have in my entire body. And he's like, most people cannot handle success. And the advice that he's been around super talented people, and these are some people who are legit geniuses, and they destroy their lives. I'm not interested in being successful for a year, for 5 years, for 10 years. I want to be this till I decide I'm going to stop doing this. And so his whole thing was, there's, like, basically four things that he sees, for ways that people do this the most.
Ruin their success.
They are successful, they're talented, and they destroy themselves. Yeah.
Oh, what are the four?
So the first one was drugs. Pills, all, heroin, all this stuff. I don't do any drugs. That's not gonna happen to me.
Did you see the Eddie Murphy documentary?
No, everybody keeps telling me that about
it. Oh, it was so good, dude. And one of the main things was, you know, he was famous since he was 16. He was on SNL, I think, when he was 18. And, you know, did all these movies when he was 21. He was like, I've never done drugs. He's like, that's one of the main reasons why I am what I am.
So he's going to be number three on this list, which we'll get to in a minute, about what could destroy you. And he wasn't destroyed by it, but he's addicted to something else, which we'll get to. Number two, alcohol. Like, just, like, can destroy your life. You know, I had, went to dinner last night with a friend, and, like, I had a glass of sake, like, but I didn't get drunk. It was, like, fine, right? Three, women. They just, like, they attract the wrong kind of women. They fall in love with the wrong kind of women. They let the wrong women in around them. Like, they're
what's
like,
Patriots coach?
Bill Belichick?
Yes. You see what he's doing now?
He's dating, like, a 20-year-old or something?
Oh, yeah, man. She just calls the shots.
Okay. Well,
it's exactly what you're describing.
No, in cases, it gets a lot darker. There's, like, just, it can distract you. It's just, you want high quality people around you in every single domain. Friends, high quality people. People you work with, high quality people. The people you date, you want high quality people. Like, you just want high quality people. It's like, it's the most important decision you make in your life is the people that you let around you, which I see people are way too casual about this. And I could be really, really ruthless in this domain. And then the fourth one is megalomania. And the reason I say Eddie Murphy, because, like, he's, like, dated every single person. He's got, like, 10 kids. I think he's got a bunch of different baby mamas. Again, he's still living his life he wants to do, but he clearly likes number three. So number four is just megalomania. You start to think that you're successful because of you and not the work that you put in. And you start to believe you have, like, you're like a god, and, like, everybody should, you know, praise you. And you just completely become disassociated from reality. And this is why I say, like, it's very dangerous, especially to, like, do numbers driven thing. Like, I talk to founders all the time. I'm like, oh, like, tell me about your company. Like, I just want to be the first, you know, I want to build a $1 trillion company. I want to be the fastest company to 100 million ARR. I'm like, you know, like, none of history's greatest entrepreneurs.
Yeah, but
none of history's greatest entrepreneurs thought
like
that.
I'm calling you out on that. That's bullshit, because when I talk to Ramp, the Ramp founders are amazing. They're, like, the best of the best. They said, our goal is to get to $1 billion in valuation in 18 months.
That was not their primary goal. Their primary goal.
But they said that's what their goal. I mean, he was like, I think it'd be cool if we could do that.
Oh, that's different. That is different. 100%. I'm saying the reason for your existence, the reason what you're doing, these people are telling me I'm only starting this company so I can hit a certain financial number. That's completely different.
No, that's not what he said. Yeah.
Yeah, that's not what they... Wasn't I there with you in the office?
I recorded with him, and he repeats this all the time. It's like that's like a cool thing. He was like, I thought it'd be cool if we could get to $1 billion valuation in 18 months.
I don't know if I heard that episode, but like...
He said it a bunch.
Okay, their experience with Paribus beforehand was giving the insight into the founding story of Ramp. So that's a longer story. But my point being is like, I'm hugely skeptical if you're... There's some kind of external metric that I will only be happy if I hit that metric, or that is the reason that I'm doing this. Where mine is just like, I want to make things that are proud of, that I think are good in, like I could put out in there, like good into the world. And I don't confuse, like when we were just upstairs, you know, like that guy sitting next to us. It's like, I don't confuse with somebody saying, hey, I like what you do. Like, that's the perfect way to say it. You like what I do. You might like me as a person. If we knew each other, we'd probably get along. We'd probably have the same interests. But never confuse that they don't like you. It's the work. And if once you stop putting in the work, everything else goes away. That is how the megalomaniacs, they just think like, I'm so talented, I just show up. Everything I touch turns to gold. I don't have to practice. I don't have to put in any effort. And everything's going to work out. And then they also, you know, treat people essentially not as people.
If you had to teach someone who is 19 how to find their life's work based off of reading about 400 people and now talking to hundreds of successful entrepreneurs, what would you say is the exercises that they should do?
My problem is, I think at that age, I wouldn't have taken anybody's advice. And I think I'm only now, the last few years, like been open to letting other people like mold my mind.
Well, what would you say?
The fact that they're asking the question. Like, there's this great line where it's like a 21-year-old kid comes up to Mozart and it's like, I want to know how to write a symphony. And he says, you're too young. And the guy that is asking Mozart the question is just like, yeah, but you wrote symphonies when you were 14. He's like, yeah, but I didn't go around asking people how to do it. There's something in there where you feel somebody else has the answer. That doesn't mean you shouldn't ask for advice. I'll be very clear here. I don't think there's anything magical I would have to say that would put them on the other path. You need to spend a lot of time thinking about what you actually believe. A lot of people just lie to themselves. They do it over and over and over again. And this long conversation last night. And the conversation started was like, what's the lie that you're telling yourself? And we went back and forth, me and this other person, for a while about this. My lie, I'll just tell you right now, which again, I'm probably sharing too much publicly, is just like that I don't need anybody else. That's a lie. That's a lie I've been telling myself for a very long time, which again has happened. And I learned that because of the experience I'm having, the relationships I have, like realizing that like you're doing that because it's a defense mechanism, not because it's actually true. And so for this, I'd be like, take the time, like what do you actually want? And that's very hard to be truthful about. And the one way that I found it is just like, I just follow, like I have ungovernable curiosity about things. I cannot tell you why I like to read. And so like when I first started my first podcast, I was like, oh, like it'd be cool if I could like build a business and a life where I just get to read all the time, which sounds ridiculous. But it actually worked. And then you just follow this. And then now to the point where like we recorded this conversation with Todd Graves, who's one of the people I wanted to meet the most, which people sounds crazy. But I'm like, he's like, what does he do? He's like, he sells chicken fingers. And they're like, what? Why do you want to meet him? I was like, because he grinded himself. First of all, he's been doing his business for 30 years, started out, built the first store by hand. He had no money, went to crazy risk to find the financing because there's no venture capital and no one would give him money. He had to like risk his life on a boat, sailing off, fishing off Alaska. He worked as a boilermaker. He was like highly leveraged and almost went out of business. He did all these crazy things because he just found he had this chicken finger dream. That's what he calls it. And it's like, I have to do the chicken finger dream. I can't explain why. Again, he's not external, looking for external validation. I'm going to do this. Everybody's like, you're an idiot. You can't do that. It hasn't changed his menu in 30 years. So we fly to Baton Rouge. The conversation is incredible. We record for two and a half hours. And then we spend another 2.5 hours one-on-one together after.
Was he any different?
No, because these people, and he also listens to the podcast. So he understands who I am. Like, it's just very, this is what I meant. It's like, I don't make media. I'm building relationships.
He might be a top 10 person I've listened to on your pod.
Yeah, he's incredible. And so this is the point about following the curiosity, going back to the 19-year-old. I go back to the airport and I call Sam Hinkie. And he picks up and I go, I'm in big trouble. And he goes, what's going on? I go, I am already wildly addicted to having these conversations. He goes, I've never done ecstasy, but this is how I feel right now. I am like high, I am wired. I am like high as a kite because I had this guy, again, he's got 3 decades of experience. He had 915 stores. The company's worth over $20 billion. He owns 90% of it. He's growing faster in year 30 than it ever has in its history. He still has trouble sleeping because he can't wait to wake up and get back to work the next day. And so you just get like, you get this download of information and energy from him that like just made me euphoric.
Who would be on your board of advisors? Would he be on one of them?
How many people do I get?
6.
I have to name them?
Yeah.
Living or dead?
Either.
Let me do dead just because that'll give me some time to think about living. And I think like, I don't know if I want to answer that question honestly, but I would have to. Dead, you know, Rockefeller. Built the greatest company ever created.
I think, is one of the few tycoons of, in terms of like unimpeachable character and like amazing success, I think he's the best.
Debatable and unimpeachable character.
No, okay. Unimpeachable is not the right word because he screwed up. He did lie on the record a bunch of times. But in general, I think he's an ethical, honest person.
Got a little handsy towards the end of his life. Let's just put it that way. I remember I collect
obscure, he was 100.
I collect obscure Rockefeller biographies. I have made my own. I have one at my house I haven't done an episode on. It's 1,700 pages long. It's in a big binder.
He was a weirdo when he was like 90 and he was like giving people nickels and shit.
That's fine. Great. He undeniable. One of the best businesses ever created. Charlie Munger told me to my face that he thinks Rockefeller created the best business in history.
Yeah. Okay?
Munger would have to be on it because he's dead, unfortunately, now. I think he's the wisest person I've ever studied. If I could only like emulate, learn from one person, it'd be him. Edwin Land, founder of Polaroid, patron saint of Founders Podcast. He was Steve Jobs' hero. His whole thing, he's got a lot of things that, a lot of personal mottos. He invented the instant photography, the entire industry, then monopolized the industry. It's like one of the last great American technology companies that were never like, his patents were never...
What did he die? I've never heard of him.
In the 90s? When he was in his 70s, Steve Jobs met Edwin Land when Steve was like 25. Edwin Land was like 72, I think. And he said, Steve Jobs said that spending time with him was like visiting a shrine. This is how a lot... I get to meet like crazy people in the world, right? I actually had lunch with a friend yesterday. And she told me something fascinating. She just was like, you need to like take a minute to think about what's going on in your life and the fact that you have this ridiculously sick life because of the people you have like access to.
You ever write this stuff down, like a journal?
No, this is like, I think one of the reasons I wanted to do the Bruce Springsteen episode is because I think I like run from my past. I don't like thinking about it. Like there's just all kinds of other stuff going on. And so I spent time yesterday with a 71-year-old guy. It looks like he's gonna do his first ever podcast interview with me. He just sold his company for $60 billion. And in an hour, he transferred like more knowledge to me than I would weeks speaking to like a young startup founder. It's just unbelievable that. So Edwin Land, I felt, did the exact same thing for Steve Jobs. And Steve Jobs like would essentially he patterned Apple off of Polaroid. And a lot of people don't understand that. Like to the point where like you can go and walk back and watch Steve's product demonstrations. And the table and chairs that are on that are the exact same ones that Edwin Land did for Polaroid. People don't actually see. If you're not studying history, you don't have this like basis of historical knowledge in your head. You actually don't know what you're looking at. Like I saw something different when I saw that video than somebody that didn't study history does. It's like very, very valuable. And this is like, we're wasting time doing dumb shit, like watching short form videos all day, you being obsessed with the news, following X. Like this stuff is garbage. It's just like read books and talk to really amazing people and try to like apply what you're learning from both those experiences to be a better human. And then the better human you are, other better humans will then open up to you. And then there's like this virtuous cycle.
You have 3 more.
So Rockefeller, Munger, Land, obviously Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs built, you know, the most successful consumer product of all time. I will say about Edwin Land, I took 2 ideas from him. He had his personal motto was don't do anything someone else can do. I think that's different, demands differentiation. When you listen to my podcast, they are very weird. Founder, there's not like, you can read books and have a solo podcast. You're not going to make it like that. It's a very weird thing. Even the way I'm doing the new show, everybody's like, this guy interviews weird. I'm not interviewing a goddamn person. I am having conversations. What you're hearing on the show is exactly what you would hear if we weren't recording this. This is the stuff I have. The idea that all these guys, everybody that's been on the show besides James Dyson so far, has listened to the podcast. You think, first of all, a lot of the early listeners for the new show come from founders, right? And some of the messages I get, they're like, yeah, but like, you're like talking too much and like, you interrupt and you do all this other stuff. Like, you should do it the way this guy does. We just did 400 episodes of people that build lives and phenomenal careers by being differentiated. And now you're like, no, don't be differentiated. Go do it like this other guy. The differentiation I have compared to other podcasters that want to talk to excessively successful people in business is they haven't read 400 biographies about history's greatest entrepreneurs like I have. I spend time with Daniel Ek all the time. I just saw Michael Dell again last week. I promise you, they don't want me to not talk. That is not what they want. They listen to the show. And so this idea from Edwin Land is like, don't do anything someone else could do. That is a very, very simple sentence and a very profound insight if you actually apply it. Most people are so scared to be different.
Because your recall is so good.
I wasn't born with that. It's work. It's 10 years of reading and then rereading and then like building my own database. And then like, I've done all kinds of crazy shit that no other podcasters do. Cause you know, like I talk to other podcasters and I ask all kinds of questions. It's like, everybody's like, you are blessed with phenomenal memory. No, I forget everything all the time, but I don't forget something if I've read it 15 times.
I was up in your room and I took a photo of your book. You had the Brad Jacobs book.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just want to see what he's underlining. I was like, I just want to see like his thinking. You underlined so much stuff. You had so many notes in there.
Yeah. But this is because again, like I also love what I do. And if you love what you do, you're going to do things that are not for financial reasons. You do it because you want it to be great. Like I am killing myself over this edit right now. The episode that I'm working on right now is probably 4 days late and I still don't have it. And like, I feel uncomfortable right now, but I know that's a good feeling because like when I get on the other side, this happened. I did this episode called How Elon Works. I think it's the most downloaded episode of Founders by far. And I remember talking to a friend because I was working in Malibu and I was like, it's just not ready. Like I can't, like I am struggling. Like it was supposed to be out on Sunday. It's not coming out. But the thing that I realized is like, no one's going to remember if it came out 4 or 5 days late. They're going to remember if it was great or not. And spending that extra time and being confused is like a good signal. It means that I care and then I'm trying and I will find my path, like my way there. So I think that's really important. So let's go back to the other thing about Edwin Land real quick. He also has this great line. They says, this is where I said I was lying to myself about wanting a balanced life. He says, there's a rule they don't teach you at Harvard, which he knows because he dropped out of Harvard twice. He goes, there's a rule they don't teach you at Harvard that anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. I can't hold myself. Like I have to take things as far as they can go. That's why I can't do many things. I essentially can just do podcasts. I could take care of my health. I could do podcasts and I could build relationships. That is essentially all my 24 hours a day. That's all I have. I can't do anything else. So Edwin Land, Steve Jobs, Rockefeller, Munger, two other dead people. I don't think I need the other two. I like fewer, deeper relationships. I tend to talk to like the same people over and over again. You know, being public figures, you could talk to 1,000 people a year if you wanted to. I find that like, I want to genuinely know people who they authentically are. I want them to know who I authentically am. And then like, I want to skip all the bullshit and I want to get right to like the actual stuff that we're going to talk about. I want to talk about your relationships you have with women. I want to talk about like the guilt that you have being on the road all the time and the fact that you're a dad. I want to talk about the stuff that you lied to everybody else about. Like, this is the only stuff I'm interested in. I cannot have like superficial conversations. Like, I remember one time this guy reached out, he was a billionaire and he's like, I'd love to talk to you. I was like, sure. And then he's like, I got like looped in with his assistant. I don't even have an assistant. I do everything myself. So like, besides, I guess the new show, now I have a whole squad that you see. But I remember getting the calendar invite and it was like 30 minutes. I'm like, we're not even going to get started in 30 minutes. Like, and so I was like, this isn't going to work. Like, tell me when you have like more time, like, but I'm not going to talk to you for 30 minutes.
All right, let's take a quick break because I got to tell you a story. Let me tell you about the first time I tried to run payroll for my team. I was using a traditional bank and you know the type. It's got a janky interface. It's built like a 2002 tax form and it was open only during business hours. And I hit send and it froze. They flagged the transaction. They locked my account. They put me on hold for 45 minutes. And then they told me I got to visit my local branch. And that was the day I started looking for a new banking solution. After asking a few founders what they were using, I found out about Mercury. And so now my payroll is 2 clicks. I can wire money, I can pay invoices, I can reimburse the team, all from one clean dashboard. That's why I use it for all of my companies. And so do 200,000 other startup founders. And so if you're looking to level up your banking, head to mercury.com and apply in minutes. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services are provided through Choice Financial Group, Column NA, and Evolve Bank & Trust, members FDIC.
What do you think would be the, the biggest regret of the of all the people that you've talked to? What would be the top three biggest regrets that they've had?
I this is where it's like, with these kind of people, I don't necessarily believe them, that they're regrets. Like, so Sam Walton, he's writing his autobiography as he knows he's dying. He's got cancer all over his body. He's in immense pain. He took out some of the last time that he ever had in life, and he essentially distilled what he learned from his like 50, 60 year career. And I think it's one of the best books, easily top five, you know, entrepreneur book of all time. And it's like such a gift to future generations of entrepreneurs that he did that with his last time. And he said that, you know, he missed out a lot of stuff. Like, he was working all the time. He's like he calls himself a fairly overactive fellow. Yeah. And well, that's one way to put it, Sam, but like that you're just a conqueror. You're an insane person in a good way. He's trying to do something, you know, that he thought was good. And he's like, you know, if I had to be honest though, like, yeah, I missed out on seeing, you know, parts of my kids' lives. Like, I was working a lot. But he's like, if I did it all again, I would do it the exact same way. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And they get to the end of their life. And then they're like, I think it's just natural to be nostalgic and to think, oh, what I would change. But like, even Buffett says in Snowball, whatever he did to draw, to like push his wife away, his first wife, I would go back. He says, I would go back and like do it differently. Maybe, I don't know. Like, I think he did exactly what he wanted to do. Maybe in that case, he's right. He's like, I was like truly in love with this woman and I messed that up. I could see that being like a true regret. I think a lot of these people have a hard time assessing like their own regrets accurately.
There's this great book called How to Get Rich. Have you read that one?
Felix Dennis, yeah. Episode 129.
Yes. One of my favorite, books of all time, because his writing is really good. It's the best. He's like if Mick Jagger and Richard Branson had a baby. His writing is the best. And it's one of the very few books that's tactical and written by a billionaire. And so he the reason it's a good book is he was dying. He was dying of cancer. I think he died when he was 60 or something. And he said, if I could live life all over again, I would accumulate $50 million as fast as I can, hopefully by the age of 35. And then I would spend the rest of my life writing poetry.
Yes.
And the reason I believe him is he spent the last 10 years of his life retired writing books and poetry. And his philanthropic issue or thing was planting forests. He loved trees. It was very strange. He also like said in the book, he's like, I've spent $100 million on whores and crack.
Cocaine over a decade. I was going to bring that up. Where like, this is.
Okay. But anyways, he was a crackhead. He was a legit.
I didn't know it was crackhead.
It was crack. He was a crackhead. Right around here, actually, in this neighborhood.
I believe him because he got to like 500 to 800 million. Like, he got way.
Yeah, but this was like in the year 2002. So like.
Even more.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you read that book. And again, this is why like I spend so much time with these older people, because there's like a certain like, you don't know yourself as well when you're younger. You're still on the rise. And so you're incentivized to like put on a show. Essentially, like, you're not being truthful and you can't let the world actually see how you like what you believe about certain things. And especially in like this entrepreneur ecosystem you're in, like, most of these startup founders are just straight up lying so they can raise more money. Like, it's really gross and disgusting. This is my whole thing. I am fundamentally, if I'm being dishonest about something, or if I have like different sides of me, I don't like that. I need to reconcile that right away.
I've gotten so much more value out of listening from old people than I have reading Twitter or whatever.
It might be because they're willing to tell you the truth.
Well, and it's also because once you get past a certain level, and that level honestly is pretty small, but like, once you get past a certain level, the analogy that I heard recently was really good. It was like, I'm the captain of a boat and I'm not trying to fix the engine, but steer the ship. And so I don't necessarily need tactics right now. I just need, tell me how to live like a good life. And a good life is a variety of things, but like, I need to know about what the definition of a life worth living is, not how to make money or whatever. I don't know, whatever the tactics are. And so I've gotten so much more value. So my friend Noah Kagan's got this channel on YouTube where he interviews like 80-year-olds and mostly like entrepreneurs. I've gotten so much more value out of that.
You see this, if you can't interview them, at least you can pick up like Felix Dennis's book, where how many people are going to be honest about? That is a crazy thing to admit to, that I spent $10 million a year for 10 years, $100 million on prostitutes and coke.
Dude, crack. When he died, his prostitute girlfriend was living with him.
So this, again, like, I'm sure, I can't imagine the STDs this guy has or had. And doing coke and drinking in nightclubs, because these are like nightclubs, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, like in the 80s.
It's just like, you don't want to do that. Like, what are you doing? Like, it's going to shorten your life. And some people want to. Like, there's a great line in Bruce Springsteen's autobiography where he's like, some people's 5 years is worth more than other people's 50. You know, so like, some people just have to burn bright, and like, they're going to, that is like their destiny. That's what they're going to do. I want to like have a very interesting life, and I want to succeed decade after decade after decade.
Were you making any money in the first 5 years?
Back then, so this is a long story, but like, there was, the podcast advertising is not like how it is now, which is like way more advanced, and like, you can sell your own deals independently. So at that time, there was like these, they call them podcast networks, but they're not, I guess, they're not, there wasn't a network podcast. They would just sell ads for you. And so I just remember reaching out to one of them, and they're like, we would love to like sell ads for you. It's like, you need 50,000 downloads per episode.
And what did you have, 1,500?
The number they said, I was like, 50,000? I was like, it seemed like such a, it's like, I will never have that. Like, I couldn't compute. So I don't even know what I had, a couple thousand or whatever the number was back then. And so then you would like try to do like, you could do like affiliate deals. Like, remember Audible scaled on podcasts. People don't understand the size of businesses you can build on the back of podcasts to this day. And now I don't even talk about this publicly anymore, because like, I think this is a secret of mine.
Like, my business has made a lot of money via podcasting because I promoted my company Hampton on there.
And there's just a million examples that people don't even know. Like, I've collected all these cases.
The hard part is that podcasts are like the most challenging to grow, but they're the most sticky, I think, of all the mediums.
Oprah understood the intensity of a legitimate parasocial relationship back in the 80s, way before, like, nothing we're doing is new.
She had built-in distribution, right? She hooked up with the network, and that was, and there was only 60 channels.
I did an episode on that. That might be 332. I might be wrong on that episode, but the key there, and let me just tell you her insight, and I'll tell you what she figured out, how to monetize it in such a huge way. Her key insight was, you know, she would have like Brad Pitt on her show, or like these A-list celebrities, and she's like, oh, I have something different, because the way my audience responds to like a movie star is not the way they respond to me. And so like, they're like, Brad, oh my God, you're handsome. I love your movie.
And they're like, Oprah, it's nice to see you.
No,
how
they're
are
like,
you?
Oprah, come over for lunch. Come over for dinner. When people walk up to me on the street, they like get right into it. Like,
yeah, because I think they know you.
And in many cases, they do. They know like what I'm into and like what I'm, you know, intensely interested in. And then Oprah's thing, just to close that real quick, well, first, also, I think people vastly underestimate the importance of frequency, which is like another thesis I'm about to try to prove here, where she's in your house 1 hour a day, 5 days a week. The intensity of the success of her business and the intensity of the parasocial relationship would be much more diminished if she was doing it once a week. I think that's very important. Second thing she realized is that at the time, this is all, television. The most profitable show on TV at this time was local news, right? Because it's like, cost nothing to make, and you could sell advertisers like, I want to sell my car in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah, more targeted ads.
Huge targeted, you know. And what she realized is like, if you have Oprah coming into being the lead in from 4 to 5 to your 5 o'clock news, right? She's going to bump up your rating, your Nielsen rating by like, I forgot what the number is. Let's say 3. And for every 1 Nielsen rating, your local news would make like another $5 million a year. So let's say you don't have Oprah, you just lost out on $15 million. So if Oprah says, oh, I'll sign with you, you have to pay me 5 of that. I'm making up the numbers. You have to pay me 5 of that 15. You're going to say, yeah. So what I couldn't figure out how to sell enough ads. I'll close this real quick because I've talked about this on other podcasts too. I had found this socialist podcast called Chapo Trap House that was selling, that did not run ads because they were not capitalists.
Right.
So they thought it was, you know, immoral. And they were using Patreon at the time to sell subscriptions to podcasts. And the Patreon API is public, and there's a website called Graftreon, and they were at the top of the list. And I found this, and they had 25,000 people, or 20, let's call it 20,000 people paying them at least $5 a month. And I'm like, oh, there's a business model right there. And their business model is simple. You can listen to every other episode for free. If you want the other episodes you're not getting, you have to pay $5 a month. And so I was like, well, this is like information for business. People for business would of course pay for this. And there's actually a story here. And so, but I sold it too cheap. It was like $100 a year, $10 a month. And then I grinded to like a couple thousand. So it's like, you're making like dentist money or something like that is the way I would think about it. But then—
That ain't 24 grand a year ain't dentist money.
No, you're making hundreds of thousands of a year.
I thought you said 2,000 a month. You got it.
No. Annual subscribers had like a couple thousand. Like
got it, okay.
3,000, 4,000, something like that. So that'd be like 400 grand or whatever the number is, right? But then Rob was like, you idiot. I'm trying to send this. He's like, your biggest asset you have is your back catalog, and you have a big giant do not enter sign in front of your biggest asset. He's like, I've been trying to send it to people and it's so good that you had to buy gift subscriptions. And so he's like, I spent like $900 this week sending your episode to my 9 friends. I have to pay $100 every time I want to send somebody's, so friend, my friend Sam Hinkey, he was spending like $2,000 to $3,000 or $4,000 a year. Cause he's like, this is too good. He was just buying it for everybody. He's the one that told Patrick about it, which has obviously changed my life from there. And so then here's another thing, which I didn't understand, that podcasts are not all is not that it appears from the outside. This is a lesson from Rockefeller, where he realizes that one of his advantages was that not everybody, there's posted rates on how much it's going to cost to ship a barrel of oil over the railroad. That posted rate is a lie.
Yeah, so he gets rebates.
Yes, the foundation of his empire. And so what I realized, and I remember Hinkey calls me one day, and he goes, hey, where are you? I go, I'm in the Hamptons. He's like, what are you doing there? I go, this guy DM'd me, and we talked on the phone. I really liked him, and he has this giant house in the Hamptons. He's like, will you come speak to my company offsite? And Sam's like, he's paying you for that? And I go, yeah, of course. He goes, how much? And I go, X amount. And he goes, and I go, he's paying me X amount. And then he put me in this crazy house or this crazy hotel where like the room service is like a 3-star Michelin. The restaurant downstairs, there's only one restaurant. It's like I'm ordering room service from like a Michelin star restaurant. And then I go to check in, even though I'm not paying for it. And I see what he's paying a night. It's like $3,000 a night or something like that. And so I was like, yeah, this place is incredible. It's beautiful. And, you know, and we just went over like basic numbers. And Sam goes, you have got to stop selling things. He goes, you have one of the most price insensitive audiences in the world. You cannot sell something for $100 a year. He's like, they would have paid $10,000 because like it's relative to their wealth. And so like this just happened when you said the book that you saw upstairs. In that book, Brad Jacobs, who has now become a friend of mine, sent me an early copy of that book. He did not tell me I'm in that book. He just said, here's the book. Tell me if you like it. I'm reading the book. And it says at the end for his new company, and not even the end, I think it's on page 76, if I remember correctly. He's like, most of the investors in my new company, which is now a multi-billion dollar company, are repeat investors. However, 2 of my top 20 shareholders did not know who I was. They discovered me because I was profiled on David Senra's Founders podcast. And I'm like, that's crazy. And I know the 2 people because those 2 people also told me and they told Brad. That means Brad raised $750 million from my audience, from people that didn't know he existed before I did the episode on his book. So that was Sam's point. He's like, you have one of the most price insensitive audiences in the world. You cannot sell things for $100. This guy, and the speech wasn't even a speech. We go, his whole team's at his Hamptons house. It was like 30 of us. And he just wanted to like shoot the shit in front of them for like 30 minutes and pay me unbelievable amount of money.
Dude, this is like that. I told Ben Wilson, I've been the history buff for 20 years.
And I love Ben.
And Ben's I saw friend. Ben's podcast, How to Take Over the World. And he sent me the graph. I think when I found him, he was doing 100 downloads an episode. And I was like, Ben, what's going to happen in the future is you're going to become sort of like a guru, but not in that type of way, where because you've consumed all that, this was before AI, because you've consumed all this history knowledge, billionaires are going to pay you money to help them predict the future by not repeating the past. I was like, that could be like the business model. And it was like hard to understand at the time, but it's selling your time kind of sucks. But that's like the joy of reading history. It's basically, it's like sort of education that's wrapped in entertainment. That's why I love it so much. Do you ever use newspapers.com?
I bought a subscription. I don't think I've ever gone on
it. Dude, you have to use it. It's so fun. Because the problem with biographies and like listening to your podcast is you're telling me these stories when I already know the ending. And it's so much better to go back. So for example, you could read about like Dan Gilbert. And he's just like one of the greats when it comes to being an entrepreneur. And you can read about him and watch interviews, but you know that he was successful. You already know the outcome of the story. And so it's really fun to go back. I use newspapers.com all the time because I go and find articles in the 80s and I'll find his first profile. Like the very first time a newspaper wrote about him. I'm like, what were they saying about him right then and there? Or how were they disrespecting them? Or did they like, could they spot it? Or like, because there's revisionist history. Like, what were people saying about him then and there? Because I was in San Francisco I moved to San Francisco when I was 21. And there's a bunch of like people that are ballers now. And I'm like, I knew that guy when we were nothing. I did not see that. I did not know that he had that in him. Or this person I thought was going to be the shit, they were nothing. And so it kind of becomes hard to like predict who's going to be. I mean, obviously, angel investing would be a lot easier if this were the case.
This is where I would say like the only filter I trust, like time is the best filter. And so that's why I tend to gravitate towards people that were successful for many decades. We didn't finish the, so like, if you think, you asked me the living board of directors.
Yeah.
I think this is a good segue into like what you were just talking about, where it's like, it would probably be a lot of the people that I've had on the new David Sandler show so far. So like,
Ovitz, Dell.
No, the first spot would go to Daniel Ek for sure. For sure.
He was cool because everyone's a shark who's that successful, but he had a soft side that I liked.
He is like Swedish Buddha. I don't know how to describe him. He is unbelievably philosophical and he's changed my life in so many different ways.
I can't believe he's that way at such a young age too.
And that's the way, like, we're close in age, but he is like so much wiser than I am. And I've spent a bunch of time with him. And I would say he's taught me a lot. Like he's another guy that will call you on your shit.
In a very polite way though.
Yeah, he's great. So like the reason I started doing video, the reason I'm doing the new show too is because of him. And his whole thing was just like, we were having this crazy dinner, this 4-hour dinner in New York. He's just like, why aren't you doing video? And I was like, I'm not doing this for like fame. I'm a very private person. I don't want to ever be recognized in public. And he's just like, a lot more people know what I look like than what you look like. He goes, I got recognized in the gym this morning. You know what they do? They come over and say, hey, I love Spotify. Thanks for building it. And then they go about their ways. And he's just like, I'm paraphrasing what he said. He's just like, he knew I was like obsessed with podcasting. He gave me great advice. He's like, you're easy to understand. So therefore you're easy to help. Because all you care about is podcasting. And so it's very easy for me to help you because you're
easy to understand. That's a wise line.
This is what I mean. If I only had one board of directors, it's probably him.
In the beginning of the podcast, he tells a story about how he advised Dara to take the job at Uber. And he was like, he tells this amazing story. He was like, Dara, you know, I think you should take this job. And Dara is saying like, you know, somebody nominated me to like run Uber. And Daniel was like, yeah, you seem like you've been complacent, this and that. And then he like talks about how he convinced him basically to take this job at Uber. And then he later tells in the story, he's like, I was the one that nominated you. And he didn't even tell him. He was like, I nominated you.
This is the important part. For somebody to say that to you, you seem complacent. That looks like you're criticizing. That looks like you're attacking. This is why you have to get over. Don't listen to random people. But if that person genuinely cares about you, you have to be able, this is something I struggle with. Like, he didn't curse. He's just like, essentially, my paraphrase is like, you're lying. This is bullshit. Like, get over, like, he said something about like getting on, like, I'm straddling the fence. I can't remember the exact words, but essentially just like, this is the business you've chosen. And the fact of the matter is, podcasts that have video grow a lot faster than podcasts that don't. He gives interviews multiple times. People ask him what his favorite podcast is. He says Founders. Like, he's like, he genuinely believes it's good for the world. So me not doing video means less people see it.
Yeah, it's sort of like
less impact.
A horse dealer fighting the fact that Ford is around now.
Yeah, and it's just like, what are you doing? Like, so get off the fence. And then me and Patrick's at this dinner too. And we get in the car after that and we're like, we're going to do video.
Well, Patrick didn't want to do it either.
I know. Neither of us wanted to do it. But that's why my point is, like, you have to be smart enough to change your behavior when you're reacting to new information. And so this also leads us to really, well, like, my obsession now. Founders will always be my obsession because I'm never going to stop reading. But like I'm spending a lot of time, most of my time will be on David Senra, is we get in the car. I'm going back to Patrick's house to spend the night at his house. And he's been pushing me to record podcasts and do more, what he called interviews at the time, than he did for years. And I was like, no.
Whose house do you say?
Patrick. And we get in the car with the driver and he's like, you absolutely have to start recording these conversations that you're having. He goes, I spoke 2% of the time. Daniel spoke 49% of the time. You spoke the other 49% of the time. He goes, I've known him for 4 years. You got more out of him in 4 hours than I have in 4 years. Nobody can speak to the soul of the founder like you can in the world. You have to start recording these conversations. And that is the push. I was like, oh, that's conversations different. Like, I can't interview anybody. Like, that might be interesting. There could be a differentiation there.
Are you ever going to monetize this in a different way than normal media ways, ads and subscription?
No, I don't think I'll ever do subscription again because I think
so you're only going to monetize with ads.
Yeah, I think the power of media is like it's free and readily accessible and therefore it can compound through word of mouth.
Just such a shitty business model for how much influence you have.
We'll see. I have some other thoughts on there that I will keep to myself. I think I have an earned secret. So there's one of my favorite tweets. This is what I will say. Like you mentioned like taking out interesting ideas of the books and how do you do that or whatever the case is. And maybe sometimes my interpretation may be different than other people's. I remember reading Cable Cowboy, which is supposed to be a biography of John Malone, right? And, you know, it was like, oh, he is the person that invented the word EBITDA and he has all this ways to finance and he's focused on cash flow. And there's all these other takeaways that I've heard other people describe that book. That's not the main takeaway for me. fact is, like, most industries default into like some kind of like oligarchy. And in the cable industry, I think there's like 8 like main players, and, you know, the top 2 are bigger and number 6 is a little smaller, whatever the case was. And what's fascinating is, like, he's one of the 8, yet all the other players that are essentially competitors, like, go to him to, like, learn about, like, their industry, this brand new industry that they are the ones essentially building the foundation, the one that has now grown crazy in the last, like, 50, 60 years, whatever the case is. And so one of the important parts for me where I would, like, disagree with some of the stuff I can't say publicly is, like, I saw this tweet one time, and it says, I think one of the most interesting ways to, or one of the ways to have the most interesting careers is to find an earned secret and exploit the hell out of it for decades. And this tweet was talking about Mark Leonard, who used to work in VC from Constellation Software, saying, hey, these vertical market software businesses, they are shitty for VC, but they're great if I put it in a conglomerate, and then everything that he did. So I think he started, I don't remember a number, say 50 million, 80 million, and grinded to like 80 billion, whatever the number is. And so he had that earned secret. VMS, bad for VC, good for this other way. Let me just do that. And he exploited the hell out of it for 3 decades. I think because I've strived to collect more information about podcasting than almost anybody else, I think I have earned secrets that I don't think there is any limit to what the size or the performance of the business.
No, and all the great ones, like, you know, we were talking about Oprah the other day, like, there is, the breakthroughs don't particularly have like a blueprint where you're like, and we were also talking about how like the people who are number one in certain things are literally 100 times better than number 2. So I buy into that.
Jay-Z has a line, if I'm going to make it to a billy, I can't take the same path.
And so I'll be very eager to see what you're going to do. I hate advertising. In most cases, I ran an advertising business. When you rely solely on advertising, I hated it. But if you can make money in ways where I own bits of companies that I love to promote, or if you do it in some interesting way, then it becomes good. But the traditional form of advertising, I think, is a pain in the ass business model that only captures a fraction of the value that you create. And so I'll be very eager to see how you will change that.
And here's the thing, I'm very comfortable putting out a lot more value into the world than I capture. And I just think I'm going to capture more than, like, if you go back, somebody asked me, my friend at lunch yesterday, asked me, he's like, what would like the 25-year-old version of you think of this? And I was like, I don't even know if I can think in those terms. It's like already wildly like exceeded. I'm just very happy, like where I'm at and like what I'm doing. And I know that I have.
Are you a happy person? I would describe you as a happy person.
No. Happy with the way my work is going.
Are you a happy person? I don't think you're happy.
I think this is, again, why is Daniel Ek number one on my board of directors? I already mentioned one of them, like, he's pushed me in a certain direction. Another thing that he's taught me is, like, you get around him and you realize, like, you don't have any ceilings.
Dude, those people are really rare. I've been around a handful of them. It is contagious, and I'm always curious. I'm like, who gave you that?
This is the key. This is where constant refinement of association. People hear that. They're like, great advice. They don't actually do it. So few people will do it. I'm very interested in being one of those very few. I think about this a lot. I take this very seriously. So I don't think I'm apt to answer your question. Another idea that I got from Daniel, which is on the first episode of David Center, which people should listen to if they haven't, and they have listened to it, they should watch it again. I'm going to do a founders episode based on the transcript of the conversation that I had with him, because there's so many good ideas in there. And I'm like, we printed out, it's like, I don't know, 60 pages, 70 pages, something like that. Like, it's crazy. It's like a miniature book. So impact over, and his whole thing, he's just like, you don't optimize for happiness, you optimize for impact, which is exactly the advice he gave Dara for Uber, the advice that he takes for himself. And like, I am very happy. If you saw, this goes back to like, I don't need to capture, I don't need to be, let's say whatever the number of value out into the world, and I only capture 1% of it or 2% of it. It's like, man, there's other things that are so, like, if you go and, like, you can go to the website right now and send me a message, which I might have to stop reading because it's just, like, all these messages come in all day. Most of them are positive. But if you would just go through, like, my emails, my DMs, the contact form, it's just, like, these people are like, you changed my life. And it's not me changing their life. They're, like, basically, you have all these people who are like, hey, I really appreciate what you're doing. I want you to know, like, it has an impact on my life. This guy chased me down at the airport the other day. And he's just like, you don't understand, like, the difference of my life pre and post, like, discovering your work. And so it's like, okay, that's not I can't take it to the bank and you know, deposit that. But that's not, there's a very real tangible benefit from, and then this is the crazy thing. So the James Dyson episode we just did, right? God bless Rob Moore. It took 45 emails back and forth to get that scheduled. It's just like this relentlessness. But everybody knew, like, he was my number one guy. That his first book is episode 25.
Dude, I bought a Dyson because of you.
Exactly. There you go. 25, 200, 300, episode 400. It's all about the same book. The book that changed my life. The book that encouraged me to persevere when I had no reason to persevere. There was nothing that I was seeing that, like, this is going to be a success other than just relentless self-belief that I'm going to figure this out. If I focus on it and I want it to happen, I will make it happen. Like, I feel like I have a very intense will to change, like, what I want and to happen in life to happen. And so the crazy thing is, I've been talking about this guy for 7 years. It was 7 years in the making. That when we started doing the previews for the episodes, showing the pictures, some of the trailers, some of the clips, then the episode comes out, strangers I've never met are like, I'm unbelievably happy for you.
I saw that. That was cool.
Like, how crazy is
that? I was
pretty
invested into it.
So, like, what is that? That is me capturing value. And this idea where, like, oh, I have to hit a certain number or I'm not going to be happy, that's not wise. I'm not trying to be smart. I'm trying to be consistently not stupid. And if I can be consistently not stupid over a long period of time, I think that's going to result in me being wise. And that's what I'm after.
That was a good ending.
All right, that's it. That's the pod. I feel like I could rule the world. I know I could be what I want to. I put my all in it like no days off. On the road, let's travel, never looking back. All right, my friends, I have a new podcast for you guys to check out. It's called Content is Profit, and it's hosted by Luis and Fonzie Cameo. After years of building content teams and frameworks for companies like Red Bull and Orange Theory Fitness, Luis and Fonzie are on a mission to bridge the gap between content and revenue. In each episode, you're going to hear from top entrepreneurs and creators, and you're going to hear them share their secrets and strategies to turn their content into profit. So you can check out Content is Profit wherever you get your podcasts.